But we are glad that you're here today. Hope you got off to a great start to the new year. Mine was kind of questionable this week, I have to be honest with you. Have you ever been in a situation where things just didn't go the way you wanted them to? Where something unexpected happened when you were just kind of going through normal life? So I had to take a unexpected, very quick business trip up into New York City. Flew into LaGuardia, which President-elect Donald Trump described as a third world country. And he's right on point when he describes LaGuardia Airport as that. Has anyone ever flown in and out of LaGuardia Airport? If you can do whatever you can do to avoid it, please do that if you're flying to the Big Apple. But I had to fly in and out of LaGuardia. It's the only reasonable trip I could get. And so that in and of itself, getting in and out of there, is a challenge. So my plan was to fly in. I had to get up and leave. I had to get up at 3 a.m. to be at the airport, to leave all day meetings, went to bed late that night, got a 2 a.m. text that my flight had been canceled. My goal was to be back in Atlanta around 10 and catch that very last flight from Atlanta to Huntsville, which has always been a lifesaver for me, at 11:25 Eastern time. Puts you right back in Huntsville at 11:15. But I had planned to be there about 7 just for safety and catch that 9 o'clock flight from Huntsville to Atlanta. But I got news that my flight from Atlanta to Huntsville, that 9 p.m. flight that goes back and forth, was canceled. And so I jumped on the phone with Delta, tried to figure some stuff out. And they said, look, Davin, if we can get you to Atlanta by 11:30, you'll be safe. You catch that last flight that goes over to Huntsville, we'll have you back home by a reasonable time, 11:30-ish Central time on Friday night. And I said, it's very important for me to be home 11:30 Friday night. Okay, no problem. Spent 2 days of hardcore demoing negotiations. I won't get into all that, but I was dealing with a guy that we didn't see eye to eye on where they should be and where we should be. So it was 2 days of hardcore demonstrating and negotiating. And I said, look, I got to leave. I got to get home to my family. We'll figure all this out. And he was flying to Europe. I was flying to home. And so I got to the airport. I actually was able to jump on an earlier flight and get to Atlanta in plenty of time to catch that final flight, I thought. Things don't always go the way we plan, do they? And so 30 minutes at a time, my flight got delayed and delayed and delayed and delayed. At least I was sitting in the airport, unlike a lot of people trying to fly out of Atlanta on Friday evening. By the way, in case you missed it, not a single flake of snow fell in the Huntsville, Decatur, Trinity, Caddo, Moulton, wherever you live, Hartsel area. As far as I know, no snow, no ice, no anything, but they canceled flights. And so there was some ice in Atlanta that soon had everything backed up. They were 100 planes deep on getting planes in and out of there and de-icing them and all those things. And so 30 minutes at a time, my flight was delayed until I was delayed for a good solid 5 hours. Yay, joy, fun. Running laps through the Atlanta airport, doing whatever I had to do to try to keep my patience intact as they delayed 30 minutes at a time. Not my ideal way to spend a Friday evening away from home when I had everything in my mind on how the day was supposed to go, and then nothing happened the way I planned for it to happen. Everything happened the opposite way I wanted it to happen. I did make it home, obviously. I made it home about 4:15, 4:30 Saturday morning. I've never been on a flight at 3 a.m. It's an experience, I have to tell you. But we finally got out of there and got home about 4:30 a.m. Nothing happened the way I planned it for it to happen during those times. Our text today in John chapter 2 tells the story of a family that things didn't happen the way they anticipated, the way that they planned. I want to bring you back up to speed about the Belief Project. It is a study through the story of Jesus as recorded by the disciple and friend of Jesus, John the Apostle. Here's why he says he writes the book of John, the Gospel of John. We call it a gospel. We call it a book. It's really just him telling the story of Jesus. In John chapter 20, verse 30, John says, I'm going to tell you why I wrote this book, this letter. Now, Jesus did many other signs. That's a key word. Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. So John said a lot of things happened, a lot of signs happened that I didn't record, I didn't write down for you. But here's the reason why he did write the ones he wrote that we have. But these are written, these signs are written. Here's our purpose. So that you may believe, that you may believe, the Belief Project, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, he doesn't want you to believe just for the sake of belief, that by believing you may have life. And what we'll discover in John's gospel is that's not just life. That's eternal life. That's a quality of life. That's a type of life. It's not just I get to spend eternity in heaven. It's life in the here and now, living life fulfilled and satisfied in his name, in who Jesus is. John says there's a purpose of my book, and I'm going to give you some signs. Now, signs are important. What do signs do? Signs point to something else, to someone else. The sign is never about the sign, is it? The sign is always about to what the sign is pointing. And John says the purpose of the signs that I give you in my gospel is to point you to who Jesus is. And by pointing you to who Jesus is, I hope to generate belief in your heart so that you might have life. Have you ever missed a sign? You ever been going somewhere looking for something and you missed the sign? Someone said to you, this was, and particularly before GPS, right? Like I was thinking this week when I was traveling, I do not have any idea how I would get to where I'm going right now without GPS. Just trying to return a rental car filled with gas in LaGuardia Airport, I was thankful that GPS could get me to a fuel station, a gas station. If I had not had that, I can tell you I probably would have gotten stabbed based on where I was driving and the neighborhood that I was in looking for a gas station. That sounds very stereotypical, but I'm going to go with it. Looking for signs. Before the days of GPS, signs were extremely important. They're still important. If you try to find our home, which is 100 County Road 470, technically in Trinity, Alabama, though some would put a big question mark beside that, where they would say, no, you live in Moulton or you live in Caddo. Don't try to claim Trinity. Technically, our mailing address is Trinity, Alabama. But if you're trying to find County Road 470, little road, little location, and when I tell people how to get to our house, I'm going to say, you look for the big blue sign that says County Road 470. And then you're going to see a brick sign that says, ready for it, greatest name of a subdivision ever, Theodore Estates. Who names a housing subdivision Theodore? Unless you're a big fan of Alvin and the Chipmunks, obviously. Look for Theodore Estates. Look for the sign. You ever been going somewhere and missed the sign? You ever been receiving instructions for somewhere, someone? You're going to be going down this road and you're going to see a what? Sign that says, turn here. Look here. We live in a world where signs are important. Signs get you where you need to go. They let you know because they give you information. Here's when signs are important: when you're traveling and you're hungry, or the kids are crying or screaming and they want to stop and get something to eat, and you see a little sign that says McDonald's, exit 410, 20 miles ahead. Man, that sign is refreshing to know. In just 20 miles, sometimes you hope it's 2 miles, right? In just 20 miles, this sign has told me there's something coming up. There's something ahead. There's information that's valuable. By the way, when I pull into that exit and I see the big golden arches, I expect, based on the sign, that when I walk into that restaurant, that fast food establishment, that I can order a Big Mac. I'm not expecting to order a Whopper. You know why? Because the sign points me to the fact that that restaurant is a McDonald's with all of its nutritional wealth and health. I'm expecting that sign to point me to that particular restaurant. Can you imagine if we traveled our roads with no signs? Let's check your DMV knowledge a little bit. If you have a white rectangular sign, what does that tell you? Information, right? speed limit, some type of information. If you have an octagon-shaped red sign, what does that tell you? You better be ready to stop. If you see a yellow triangular sign, what does that mean while you're driving? What? Warning, caution, be prepared for something. If you see an orange sign, what does that mean? Okay, some type of construction or road work. You guys are pretty good. You might can pass your DMV test, which I'm not sure is necessarily in the part of the world we live in. But signs are very important. Almost everything that can be purchased, leased, borrowed is advertised with a sign. Places of entertainment, TV shows, movies, stores, everything has a sign. Even churches have signs. You ever been to a church where they swap things out on the sign every week and put some type of catchy phrase? I pastored a church one time that I had to come up with some cliche, some something to put on the sign every week. One week I was preaching on the story of Jesus feeding the 5,000. I couldn't figure out what to put on the sign, so I put the title of my message, which happened to be All You Can Eat Fish and Chips, Sunday, 10 a.m. Guess what happened Sunday, 10 a.m.? A lot of people showed up with their tartar sauce expecting all you could eat, fish and chips. Like, wait, that's just the sermon title. Surprise, at least you get to hear a good message. Be careful what you put on your sign. I saw a church one time that was Hope Baptist Church. Just down the road from Hope Baptist Church, guess what there was? There was Greater Hope Baptist Church, and just down the road from that was New Hope Baptist Church. Signs are important. Lots of religious television talks about the signs of the end times. You guys like BC Comics? One of my favorite BC Comics, which happened to be written by a Christian. This is a BC comic. God, if you're up there, give me a sign. Wham! I'm up here. It's kind of end time signs that we're looking for, right? That's kind of the expectation some people have of God. God, if you're up there, give me a sign. In John chapter 2, John speaks of the very first sign of the ministry of Jesus. We'll discover in the Belief Project that John gives us seven signs of who Jesus is. Signs that point to who Jesus is and this steady call for us to believe in him. Let's pick up our text, John 2, verse 1. On the third day, that's always important, right? And the story of Jesus, what happens on the third day? On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus was also invited to the wedding with his disciples. So understand the context here. Jesus, his mother, and at least five disciples, if we go back to chapter 1, at this point, are headed to this wedding. They're there along with his mother at a wedding in Cana of Galilee. Now, weddings are big deals in our culture. Weddings were even bigger deals in that day and time. Couples would often be engaged or betrothed, it was called, for up to a year. When they had the actual wedding celebration, it was usually at least a week-long celebration. Man, you imagine having to pay for a wedding? This is a week-long celebration for family, friends, and guests. That's what happened in the life and times of Jesus. There was a week-long celebration, and so there's Jesus and his disciples and his mother, who seems to have some type of organizational role in this wedding, and they've been invited to watch this young couple be married, to celebrate along with the family and friends. And so there is Jesus and his disciples. And we pick up in verse 3, things don't go as planned. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Now that doesn't seem like a big deal to us. The wine ran out. But in that day and age, it was a major social blunder for the wine to run out. Very major social faux pas for the wine to run out. Well, why did the wine run out? We don't know if it's just Uncle Harry was drinking way more than he should have. Probably the indicators are that they had a very limited budget. Anybody ever done a wedding on a limited budget? Anyone doing a wedding on a limited budget? You're in the process right now. Very limited budget. That may be what happened. A very awkward social event occurred. They ran out of wine. That doesn't mean a lot to us. But let me tell you what it meant for them. Very embarrassing. Very embarrassing for this to happen. Very shameful for the family for this to happen. Get the context here. A social blunder of embarrassment and shame. I can tell you there were even cases in the first century where they would take families to court if they ran out of wine and food. There was an expectation level. Embarrassment and shame, a social blunder. Remember what happened in our area? I think it was last Thanksgiving. Witt's Barbecue advertised, we're going to sell, I don't remember what it was, some type of pork or meat for a certain price. What they didn't seem to tell a lot of the community is we have a limited supply of this, and we're going to take pre-orders. Man, you would have thought that World War III happened because Witt's Barbecue made a social blunder. Man, I've never seen so much aggressive attitudes about a 50-year eating establishment in our community. By the way, they don't have to sell the barbecue that cheap. They chose to. They can't help it if they ran out of wine, right? Social blunder. Man, it's amazing how people went after them, right? I'm never stepping foot back in Witt's Barbecue again. I had to get out at 7 a.m. to get there. I was reading social media like, do we really represent Jesus in this moment over Witt's Barbecue's social blunder? Little embarrassing, little mistake on their part. But are we really being Jesus in this moment if we claim to follow him? They ran out of wine. Major embarrassment, major social blunder, shame upon the family. And Mary, who seems to be some type of organizer in this event, some type of wedding planner, says to Jesus, they have no wine. Mary believes Jesus can fix the problem. Now, there's no prior recorded miracle of Jesus before this one. But Mary believes, because Mary did know that Jesus was the Son of God, that Jesus can fix the problem. Pick up verse 4. Listen to the response of Jesus. And I want to tell all of our young people and teenagers, you may not want to use Jesus' phrase here. When you respond to your mom, I'll explain it to you. And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not come." Man, it seems like a harsh response from our Lord and Savior. Disrespectful. Don't try this at home on your mom. Mom says, take out the garbage. You don't reply, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not come." Because she might reply, "Your hour has come." What is Jesus doing here? When I was 16 years old, did I say 16? I didn't say 6, did I? Did I say 16? I didn't say 8 or 12. I said 16. 16 years old. I was legally capable of driving a car. And I talked back to my mom. You know what my dad did? Bent me over a bed and whooped my butt. Did I say I was 16 years old, capable of driving a car? Not only that, but my dad was old school, like, "Hey, go cut your own limb." Like, who? That's like parental abuse, isn't it? You bring back too small of a limb and then he's going after a chainsaw to get a limb out. But you don't want to bring back too big of a limb. That's like judgment on yourself. So it's like, go pick out a limb. Are you kidding me? Like, you go pick out the limb. If you want to beat me, go pick out your limb. Don't put me through that extra torture. My dad picked out his own limb that time. Did you know that limb would not even stand upright in my room? He had to prop it into the corner. And he said, "Son, not only are you going to..." Did I say I was 16 years old? "Not only am I going to whoop you, but I'm going to leave this limb in here. Just so you know what it means if you talk back to your mom again. Woman, what has this to do with me? My hour has not come." To which my dad was like, "I'll show you hour." What is Jesus doing? What is happening? Well, one, woman is not a disrespectful term in that culture. When Jesus was on the cross, he said to his beloved mom, "Woman, John was going to provide for you," is a very common expression. What Jesus is doing here is he's establishing new parameters. Jesus is no longer just the son of Mary. He's no longer just the Nazarene that was a carpenter's boy. Jesus is distinguishing himself. "I have an earthly mother, but I am also the Son of God. My time is established. by my Heavenly Father. Jesus is on a countdown toward the cross, and he says, my eternal Father knows the time, knows the hour. This is not the time for me to be glorified. This is not the time over water being turned to wine for me to make that transition of authority. There's an authority shift happening in the life of Jesus from his earthly parents to his eternal heavenly Father. There's a transition, a shift happening in the life of Jesus, and as a result, in the role of his earthly parents in his life. My time has not come. Jesus is establishing new parameters as he begins his march toward his divine appointment with death. God the Father is in absolute control. Verse 5. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Mary understands the shift, doesn't she? Do whatever he tells you. By the way, solid advice from the earthly mother of Jesus. Whatever he tells you to do, do it. Just obey. What's Mary saying? That Jesus can be trusted. Whatever he says to do, do it. He can be trusted. He can be trusted. I know that whatever he tells you might not make much sense in our broken world, but whatever he tells you to do, just do it. Just do it. So here's what Jesus told him to do. Verse 6. There were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water, and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. So they took it. There were 6 stone water pots there used for ceremonial cleansing. In other words, these are not drinking water pots. These are ceremonial cleansing where they would go through this ritual of purifying their hands and their feet and their body. It was water that was used for washing their hands and getting the dirt off in that arid desert climate. About 150 to 180 gallons of water, obviously from the text. And Jesus says, fill it up to the brim. I don't want to leave any doubt here. I don't want you to think I'm adding wine to the mix. Fill it up to the brim with water. I don't want to be any question when all this is said and done, what happened. Fill it up to the brim. Now, this, we don't have time to get into this, but the symbolism of Jesus fulfilling the Old Testament covenant here is occurring. Jesus is replacing old ceremonies with a new covenant, a covenant that's defined by transformation, by renewal, by provision, by abundance. And I love that the servants obey here without question. Jesus says, fill it up to the brim, and then serve it to the master of the feast. Jesus is, you know, it's water, right? We don't have a water shortage. We have a wine shortage. There's no Jesus saying, hey, don't worry. I'm about to abracadabra here and work a miracle. I'm going to turn this into wine. Jesus says, fill the pots up with water and serve it to the master of the feast, who, by the way, had a lot of authority and a lot of pull and a lot of notoriety. So take it to the top. Take it to the head guy. Take it to the head honcho. Take him the water in their minds and serve it to him. And I love that the servants obey without question. Do what Jesus says. It may not make sense at times, but do what Jesus says. And that's what they do. J.C. Ryle, who's a New Testament scholar, writes about this passage. Duties, obedience, duties are ours. Listen, events are God's. It is Jesus who makes the water wine. Be faithful to obey and leave the miracle, leave the event up to God. You get that? Our responsibility is to obey, to fulfill the duties that he has called us to do as followers of Jesus. It's God's responsibility to create events. Like, stop trying to manufacture miracles in your life. Just obey. Be faithful. Jesus can be trusted. There are a lot of pastors talking today about in terms of manufacturing miracles in your life. It's not our responsibility as Jesus followers to manufacture miracles. The events are up to God. We be faithful to obey, to be servants that does what Jesus says to do. Be faithful in our obedience. Take the water, he says. Take the water. Verse 9. Look what happens from the time this water is drawn. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from. I left this little parenthesis.
Though the servants had drawn the water, he knew.
The master of the feast called the bridegroom. From the time the water is drawn and transported, somehow a miracle occurs. The water becomes wine. Don't you love how the Bible uses just like the most simple few words to describe the most miraculous events? Like there's no science given. There's no here's how it happened. Here was the response. Here was the oh my gosh moment. It's like the Bible doesn't use any of that. It's just like from the time he transported it to the time he drank it, the water became wine. The Bible uses the most simple descriptions. Miracles are simple to the Creator God of the universe. He spoke things into existence. Turning water into wine is nothing for the Creator God of the universe. And I love that Jesus just remains anonymous here. The anonymity of Jesus in this text is overwhelming. The servants knew, the text says in the parenthesis, but they did not advertise it. There's no mention of the mechanics of the miracle, the response of the people, the celebration of the wedding party because now they had wine again. There's no I told you so from Mary. There's none of those things in the text. Because the focus is always on Jesus, not on the miracle. Be careful about people whose miracles constantly call attention to anything or anyone other than Jesus. Be careful of people that stand in front of crowds and supposedly work miracles that put the spotlight on them, that put the spotlight on who they are and what they do. Be careful about people in your everyday life who are constantly calling attention to God's work as if it's something they have done or they are responsible for. If the spotlight is not on Jesus, you be careful. You guard your heart. You watch it carefully. Because every time I see miracles in the Bible, guess who the spotlight's on? It's on Jesus. Just like it is here. Water into wine. Verse 10. There's got to be something behind this. The master of the feast thinks, verse 10, he says to him, everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you've kept the good wine until now. The master of the feast accuses the bridegroom of pulling some type of prank. Like, are we on Impractical Jokers? Or like, what's going on? Is myrrh hiding somewhere in the mix here? Is there something going on? There's a prank happening. If you don't know what Impractical Jokers are, you just like went... One, you're missing out on something awesome. But two, that joke just went right past you. What's going on here? Is this a prank happening? Because it's common to serve the best wine first, and after the taste buds have been dulled, then we bring out the Pabst Blue Ribbon, right? After the taste buds have been dulled, then we drink Coors Light. But we're going to drink the best stuff first. Verse 11. This, the first of his, what? Signs. Jesus did at Cana in Galilee. Look at this. And manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. And after this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. John pulls back the curtain and he gives us a glimpse into the purpose of the miracles. twofold, he says. The glory of Jesus was displayed, was manifest, was made clear. It points to Jesus. Remember his purpose? These things I have written to you. These signs I have written about so that you might believe in who Jesus is. The glory of Jesus is manifest. And the second response here, the second purpose in these verses, the disciples believe. That generated belief in the hearts of the disciples. And this event, this miracle, this sign is preserved for us today for that same twofold purpose. It points us to Jesus and it pushes us toward belief in Jesus. Now, with that in mind, I want you to remember something important about this text. The focus of this text is not on the right or wrong of drinking alcohol. Have you ever heard that about this text? On both sides, the right and wrong of alcohol. Let me make some observations about that very subject from this text. One, what Jesus made in this text was wine. It was not grape juice. It was wine. The word used in the original language is the word for what? For wine. There was words for grape juice. John didn't use that word. He used the word for wine. As one guy I like to listen to a lot says about this text, Jesus turned, based on the original language, Jesus turned water into wine, not into a dollhouse. If he wanted to use the word for dollhouse, he'd use the word for dollhouse. He used the word for wine. Jesus turned water into wine, period. Now, understand, the wine of Jesus' day was probably more diluted than it is today, and that's why they were able to drink more of it without feeling the effects of the alcohol, because it was a more diluted type of alcohol, a lot less alcoholic content just from the preservation process alone in the first century. But don't be fooled into thinking that this was anything other than wine. With that being said, let me make some points here. One, the Bible does not forbid the consumption of alcohol. As a matter of fact, in a few places, God's people are encouraged to celebrate God's goodness with wine. To celebrate it with wine. Let me tell you the rest of the story. Drunkenness, do not miss this. Drunkenness is a sin. Period. It's a sin. Period. If you drink any amount of alcohol that impairs your ability in any way, you have drank more than the Bible allows, and you've sinned. You get that? We celebrate God's goodness. Alcohol consumption is not something that is forbidden in the Bible. You know what is absolutely forbidden? Drunkenness in any form. So what that means is alcohol, this is so important. Don't miss this. Alcohol consumption without the Jesus factor is dangerous and often ends in sin. Alcohol without the Jesus factor, without celebrating who God is, celebrating His goodness, alcohol without the Jesus factor often is dangerous and it does end in sin. I love that Jesus redeems potentially destructive things for His glory. Alcohol has some destructive tendencies. But Jesus has the ability to redeem destructive things for His glory, to be able to celebrate life and goodness. Listen to me. Excessive alcohol consumption is responsible for death and abuse and destruction and failed marriages and ruined lives. If you can't drink alcohol wisely, avoid it at all cost. Do you hear me? Without the Jesus factor. If you can't drink it without the destructive end of it, don't drink it at all. It's called living wisely as a believer. If you have struggles with alcohol, stay away from it. Stay away from it. Like any other potentially destructive sin, be wise and careful with alcohol. Here's the bottom line. I have lived, heard, and experienced too many stories of ruined and destroyed lives to take alcohol lightly. Way too many. You've lived them. You've experienced them. You've heard them. Some of you grew up in homes where alcohol destroyed your home. Some of you grew up with parents that alcohol destroyed who they were as a person. Some of you in your own life have experienced the destructive nature of alcohol. All of us have heard stories of ruin and kill and death and children being taken from this world way too early and innocent people dying at the destructive hands of an issue like alcohol. We've heard too many stories to realize its potentially destructive nature. So without the Jesus factor, right? Be wise. Be careful with something like alcohol. I would say the same thing about food. I would say the same thing about sex. I would say the same thing about a lot of things that have the potentially destructive nature outside of the Jesus factor. Are we all on the same page here? Right? So we don't go either extreme. We don't say Jesus turned water into grape juice because wine is a complete sin. That's speaking out of ignorance on this issue, but we don't go the other way either. We don't use alcohol as a free license to abuse it, go against it, to drink more than we're supposed to have who we are as a person impaired by it. Here's the bottom line for me. What are your children learning from you about alcohol? What are your kids learning from you about alcohol? We have this conversation with our children. And I hope that my kids hear me say more and talk more about the potential destructive nature of it than they do the good of it. I hope that we can somehow strike that balance to teach our kids that in Jesus, there is things that are worth celebrating, and God has put his blessing on certain things that we can enjoy because Jesus has redeemed our souls, that I don't have to get drunk because of Jesus, that I don't have to take alcohol to its destructive end because Jesus has transformed me, that Jesus controls my life. Alcohol doesn't control my life. Jesus controls my life. And so I hope that we can do things and consume things in a healthy, God-honoring, Christ-centered way like alcohol. And I want my kids to understand that. Here's how I grew up, Devin. One sip is a sin against God. You know what it made me want to do? If I'm going to go all, if one sip's a sin, I'm all in. Why stop with one sip? I've already crossed the line. Right? What I want to teach my kids, not just on the alcohol issue, but in life and whole, is a healthy way to think about things through a gospel center lens in issues like alcohol. But don't miss the point here. Alcohol's not the primary point of the story. Don't get bogged down in it. What is the point of the story? Listen to this. I love this about this story. What this story teaches us is that Jesus cares. Listen, Jesus cares. In this case, Jesus cares about the non-critical, non-eternal moments of life. I love that Jesus wants to spare this family embarrassment. He's not raising Lazarus from the dead in this moment. He's not making deafened ears to hear. He's not taking the guy who can't walk and enabling him to walk. He's saving a family from embarrassment. Jesus cares about you at that personal level. The non-critical, non-eternal matters of life. Jesus cares about the small things in life. His very first miracle recorded in John's gospel is not the biggest miracle of all. It's pointing forward to other miracles. It's pointing forward to more events. But in this very first moment, after John is just in chapter 1, introduced us to the eternal God of the universe who created the world with a spoken word, that God who became flesh and lived among us full of grace and full of truth, that God, in his very first recorded miracle, says to us, I care about you in the most intimate level of all. He saved a family from embarrassment, from a social blunder. That's the Jesus we serve. That he cares about you in the simplest matters of all. Man, we love to bring our big problems to Jesus, don't we? And we should. He wants us to. But I love the fact that Jesus delights in the everyday matters of our life. He saved them from embarrassment. James, the brother of Jesus, says, bring your cares to Jesus because he cares for you. We're his children. Of course he cares about us at that level. I care about what's going on in the life of my kids. I care about their everyday. I care about what happened at basketball practice. How does school go? I know you don't want to talk. I know you're a teenager, but I know that you're focused on your phone right now. But what happened at school today? What's going on in your life right now? What's going on with your friends? You know why? Because I'm their dad, and even when they can't see it, I care about the intimacy of the details of their life. Obviously, if they go through something huge, I want them to turn to dad in those moments. But the day-to-day, the everyday life, day in and day out, I'm their father. They're my kids. I care about the details. And in this story, Jesus cares about the details, doesn't he? It wasn't a sin. It wasn't an eternal matter. It wasn't life and death. It was a social blunder. And in this moment, the text screams to us, Jesus cares for you in the most intimate matters of life. He cares for you in the everyday, the going to work, the commute, the back and forth, the parenting, who you are as a husband and wife, the mom and the dad, the TV, the everyday matters of life. Jesus cares. That's the God we serve. He's not a killjoy. This miracle speaks to the fullness of joy that's found in Jesus. Jesus doesn't stop the celebration and say, well, it's all over. There's no more wine. Go home. We should be embarrassed. What does he do? Jesus says, take the water to the master of the feast. This is the best wine. Why did you save this wine for now? Jesus says, what's Jesus saying? Keep the celebration going. Keep the party going. There's life worth celebrating. Jesus cares. He cares. Eternal life is about abundant life, life that is deep and meaning and fulfilling. It's not superficial and meaningless and temporary. It is satisfying. Ultimate contentment is found in Jesus and what he offers. Here's what else this text teaches us. Just two more quick things. One, Jesus can be trusted. He can be trusted. He desires to meet our needs, physical, spiritual, emotional. And Jesus can be trusted to do so. He shows us grace personified. Rest in Jesus. Lean into Jesus. Jesus can be trusted. He can be trusted with the big things. He can be trusted with the small matters. He can be trusted with the big stuff going on in your life. And he can be trusted with those small, intimate details of worry and anxiety. And you think in your mind, this is not even worth bringing to God, these matters. Remember Jim Carrey and Bruce Almighty when he's God? He's got all these sticky notes everywhere. And he's trying to answer all these prayers. And he gives this picture of God, like God's trying to manage a million sticky notes at one time of everybody's prayers and concerns and worries. Listen to me. Jesus can be trusted with the big stuff, and he can be trusted with the small, intimate details of life. Rest in him. Lean into him. You may think in those moments it's not even worth praying about. Lean into him. He can be trusted. Or you're worried about that test, lean into him. That promotion at work, rest in him. What's the next step in my life? Lean into Jesus. I'm not feeling like a good parent right now. Rest in him. I'm not sure I'm treating my spouse like he or she deserves to be treated. Rest in him. He can be trusted. Lean into him. He cares about the most intimate matters of life. And then Here's the last thing we're going to end it that I love about this text. It reminds us that Jesus is the Creator God. He turns water into wine. He takes the ordinary and makes it extraordinary. This is what this text reminds us right out of the gate. Jesus is in the new creation business. That's what we saw in John 1, right? He spoke and things were created. In the gospel, Jesus is in the new creation business. Paul says, if anyone is in Jesus, they are a new creation. Jesus is in the creating business. And this text is all about Jesus. We put him in the spotlight. It's not about how he spoke to his mom. It's not about the wine issue. It's not about the confusion of the servants. It's not about the social faux pas of the day. This story is a sign. It is a sign pointing to who Jesus is. A sign that proclaims in bold letters with giant lights and spotlights of who Jesus is. A sign that says, believe in him. Believe in Jesus. Believe in Jesus. Rest in Jesus, because he's in the transformation business. He turns water into wine. He turns sinners into saints. He turns the old into the new. He turns the broken into the whole. He turns the guilty into the redeemed. Believe in him. These things have been written for us. Why? So that we might believe in Jesus. It's all about Jesus.